Today in the Grave Talks, how do spirits see us? A conversation with Amanda Yenny. When you grow up in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, suspicions and cautionary tales run wild as part of the unique culture of the area. But were all these tales and superstitions just myths of a bygone era? Or could there be something more to these beliefs? That's a question that Amanda Yenny wanted to find out for herself as she embarked on a scientific journey into the paranormal. However, she was not on a quest to prove the existence of entities. She wanted to know how and why they do what they do, with an understanding that they're already there. Today, an in-depth conversation with her about the origins and path that spirits take today.
It starts really far back for me. So I am probably one of the few people in the paranormal field that did not have an experience when I was younger. I knew people that did. And growing up, I would say probably as early as five as I can remember, my mom and grandmother talking about ghosts and spirits visiting. And I grew up hearing the stories of when an uncle I had in some distant war, I want to say World War II, perhaps, the moment that he died, he had visited his wife that was still in the States, and she saw him before she knew he had passed. So I grew up with stories like that. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that they were weird or strange. My whole family had that. And it never dawned on me that I didn't. They did. So I grew up with it being the paranormal, being something, just actually very normal. Obviously, yeah. We didn't call it paranormal at the time. It wasn't even called weird. It was just an understood connection that people had and that you could exercise that connection, I suppose, mm-hmm. in certain circumstances. So as I grew up and still hearing about this, I'm the type of person, I'm very curious. I was curious as to how would this possibly happen? How could it happen? Mm-hmm. And so when I got into it, thinking more about it, trying to read more about it. So I started off, you know, probably preteen to early teen, reading ghost stories and trying to watch shows and talking with people. And at the time, I grew up in basically the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. Mm-hmm. So with the mountain grannies and hearing all those stories. Mm-hmm. And it was just completely fascinating. So as I got older, you know, you do the normal things, teenager, and like being in your 20s and then getting married and going to school and doing all those things. And I got formally back into the field later, probably about 16 years ago now. Mm-hmm. But I have a different approach. So everybody, you know, when we go out and you do an investigation, can you tell me your name? Why are you here? What happened? I'm the person that still does, not to sound callous, I don't care why you're here. Mm-hmm. I care how you're here.
Sure.
So what is it that you're doing to get here? So, I've got a science-based, a STEM background. So I'm an undergrad in math and my PhD operations research, which is basically just statistics. It's decision-making science through the use of mathematics. Mm-hmm. I've studied physics. I've studied different forms of science, you know, sometimes as a hobby, sometimes formally, to understand what is really going on. And so that's the focus that I'm at here today. But it goes all the way back, you know, to being little, sitting in the house, listening to these mountain grannies tell stories or my own family tell stories.
That must have been a really interesting atmosphere to grow up in. You laugh as I say that. In that setting, in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. I mean, for those who don't kind of understand the culture and stuff, could you kind of expound upon that and explain a little bit more about what life's like there and some of the belief systems and things like that are talked about?
So life there, now granted, this was many years ago, and I have no idea what it is now because mm-hmm. I've not been back in a very long time, but I can only imagine it is very similar. So you know, the settlers in the Appalachian Mountains, most of these folks came from Scotland or England and other places that settled, and then that's kind of where they were. So a lot of those belief systems moved with them. So very superstitious belief systems. So if you can picture it, so that this would be like in an old house that somebody likely built themselves, that generations have lived in. The setting is, you know, huge Appalachian Mountains around you, and it's always, especially in the spring or winter, it's very misty. So it has that atmosphere like you would read in a ghost story.
Yeah.
Which is why I loved it so much, I think. And, you know, the grannies, we call them the grannies, and it's basically just grandmother, great-grandmother, but very, very matriarch-centered, surprisingly. Even though, you know, the men would go out and work and do stuff, you just don't piss off granny. Mm-hmm. So very, very land-based. You know, there was a remedy and a natural remedy for everything. And, you know, if something bad happened, sweep your house with salt and all these other things that they would do, and natural herbs and roots, constantly drying and, you know, making stuff up and not making it up, but using these old traditions. And I feel bad. I'm a bit separated from it now, so I don't quite remember all the things that they would do, but being very superstitious, and that went into everyday life. And I think that embraced the concepts of ghosts, and it was very much, you know, like evil spirits and good spirits, and good spirits were okay, and you could invite those in, and also very religious too. So very, very various Christian-based religions going on there. You know, I actually turned out atheist, so I do have a separation from that, but that's the culture there. But it's very family oriented. You know, you could always go in and get like a great cobbler and listen to granny tales. And that's what I grew up calling them, were granny tales.
Yeah. Growing up and hearing those and being in that area, you know, obviously you're going to hear a lot of stories that are, you know, outlandish and are like, wow, you know, it's a scary story. Were there any, though, that when we're talking about the story based things or even some of the superstitions that, you know, time and space have given you, you look back and go, maybe there was something more to this or to that story?
Well, it's funny you mention it, because one of the big scary stories, or one of the big lore tales that has made its way even into TV, is The Woman in White. But The Woman in White is a real tale. It's a real story that I grew up hearing. And it's one of those things where you don't necessarily believe it the first time you hear it, but then you hear it so much and you hear it in different ways. And all of a sudden, all this kind of anecdotal, not evidence, but circumstances, and you start to like, well, huh. And The Woman in White has various versions of it, as I mentioned, but I always grew up hearing about the ghost of a woman, and she was always connected to somebody in town, and it was always a warning. So she wasn't a bad thing, but she always appeared in white. She always appeared like by herself, always at night, and not necessarily on a road. She could appear anywhere. But it was a warning to you. And so I remember, you know, many times when we're visiting family or visiting friends, and you're in the middle of the woods and you're little, and I'm constantly looking out like, am I gonna see her? And I'm actually looking for her. I would say now I don't necessarily believe it, that a woman in white appears just to warn you. I'm not even sure really how it got started or why, but it was just one of those things. I don't know, but when I do look back, so many people had the same version, and, you know, across towns. And we would visit people, not just the foothills of Georgia, but deep inside the Tennessee, Virginia mountain line. And they all had the same version of the story.
So
or various versions.
Yeah. So the woman shows up on the side of the road. How does your version of it go that you grew up hearing?
Oh, she could show up anywhere in your yard, never in the house. I never heard of it or her popping in the house, but she could be anywhere outside, basically. And usually I always, in looking back in my memory, I always just assumed she'd be in your front yard or somewhere close to your house. So,
an interesting thought on that, because there's obviously variations of it all over the country. Sometimes sometimes it is on a road and they get in the car, and sometimes it is just being seen out there. An interesting thought of the location and where you hear that story on a frequent basis. Do you guys, or did you guys, when you were there, have the fog that would be very mysterious? Sometimes it would literally be just like a puff of fog out by there by itself. And that just like a single little piece in an, especially when you're driving through mountains and things like that. I wonder how much something like that, like a natural condition where it is creepy to see, because you look out your window and there's just like a cloud on your ground and that's it. And it kind of moves, you know, with the space. I wonder how much that is what the woman in white is for that area, where people would see that and go, that's the woman in white. And we're picturing, you know, like literally a woman standing there in white. How much was it more so the conjecture of this is what was seen? And if you see that, it's called the woman in white and that's an omen.
Oh, I would imagine the deeper you go into the mountains and the deeper we went into the mountains, the more the story was, and it would make sense. So if you've ever been through terrain like that, it gets very misty, very foggy, and it lingers. Mm-hmm. So couple that with woods and, you know, the type of woods that they have there, a lot of that are pine with young hardwoods coming up. And since mist and fog stays, you can absolutely get the shape of a human figure, I suppose, in that. So it's not that uncommon to see the deeper in you go. Mm-hmm. So, but the further out you go where there's not a lot to hold on to the ground, then you start getting, you know, fog pockets. I don't know what else to call them.
Sure.
And then the further away you go where it's not an issue, you don't really hear about it. So I would say there is probably a strong correlation between just atmospheric conditions and people's beliefs. So once it got started, like everything else, there's a lot of confirmation bias. Oh, I saw that too. I saw, you know, what they think is a human, and likely maybe it's just a tree obscured by fog.
Mm-hmm.
So let me very ask, likely.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just an interesting one to maybe connect some dots on. Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. As you got older, obviously, and you got into studying and into science and math and all that, as you dove deeper into the academics of all this, did that further your curiosity or belief that there's ghosts or things like that out there? Or did it kind of pull that back a little more as it made you think more and more about possible logical explanations for these things that people experience?
So there's two sides to that.
Okay.
So being in academia and studying this, especially in the sciences, I'll address the first one of pulling back and finding logical explanations. I would say that's very prevalent. It's the more that you learn, the more you can weed out, you know, not every bump is a ghost. You know, there's the house settling, being able to identify a noise and kind of combing that out to understand, you know, am I really hearing something or is it just ambient noise, but now I'm paying more attention to it.
Yeah.
So there is that logical side that pretty much can dismiss. Like, I'm not a huge fan of orbs. I've seen dust under a microscope. For me, an orb is dust. It's very difficult. Unless the orb's going to write my name in the air, probably going to think it's dust.
Yeah.
But the other side of that pulled me closer to the paranormal, because I view it as basically another field of science we just don't fully understand yet. Mm-hmm. It's nothing more than modern science would have been considered, you know, mystical and magical way back.
Sure.
But now, because we understand it. So when, you know, you study physics and, you know, thermodynamics, and you know, you understand energy cannot be created nor destroyed. And that's a favorite thing to say, simply transformed. Well, what happens? Well, our consciousness, is it the actual physical body that gives us that? Or is it the energy that we have that animates the container that we're in, more or less?
Mm-hmm.
So if it leaves, it doesn't defy science to me to say that a spirit or an entity would go on. And certainly we have collected enough, you know, anecdotal evidence, and there's strong circumstances to believe that there is ghost. And so if life after death, now we don't know exactly what that is, but maybe it is wide open. Some maybe do this, some maybe not. That's why I think, you know, if people look for certain ghosts and they're never there, well, maybe it's because they don't want to. So I kind of stopped saying, okay, I'm out to prove the existence, because that's kind of proving the why.
Yeah.
If I go on the basis of, okay, let's say for the sake of this argument or this experiment or this field of study, we're going to say that they're here. Mm-hmm. Let me investigate how that's possible. Because if I can understand how, yeah, and I can recreate it, the why will take care of itself. So no, I think science has very much pulled me more into the actual science of this. Not just the, hey, I think I caught a voice, or hey, I saw something move. Great. How did that happen? Because the earth is, and the whole universe, this is energy transfers and waves and all of these other things. I hope that makes sense. And that wasn't too rambly.
No, it does. And that's interesting, because I mean, the podcast that we do, all of the shows, we are operating on the aspect of, okay, this stuff is real, but you mm-hmm. know, tell me the story. I mean, it's not a like, let's prove this or get this evidence or that. It's more so dive into the dynamics of what we are collectively saying this is happening. So tell me more about the hows and what you are finding, what you have found in your research as you've dug deeper into this. What, I mean, obviously, okay, we all end up with far more questions than answers, it seems, but I'm curious to hear some of the things that you've found that have really kind of made you, you know, raise your eyebrows and go, this is interesting. This is something I haven't considered before. Yeah.
Excellent. And I have to say, I like the fact that I get more questions than answers, because each question leads me in a new direction.
Sure.
So for somebody like me, more questions are a good thing. More avenues to investigate. Mm-hmm. So I will need to back up a little bit to when I first started formally doing investigation. So
sure. Yeah.
I was like everybody else, you know, can you tell me your name? Why are you here? Basically the same 5-6 questions we all ask every single time.
Yep.
And I noticed that there wasn't really any progress on what we were doing. Mm-hmm. People say, oh, we're investigating. Well, I started asking, well, what was the outcome? Well, what were you going in to initially try to do anyway?
Yeah.
And really, it's all about what I noticed. People say, well, I caught evidence. And as soon as you catch something, then it's, let me showcase it to everybody. And wow, look what I got. Mm-hmm. But then nothing. It's like, well, what are you going to do with that? What more is there? So with the how, I started, well, the first part of the research was to go back and kind of hit the books, looking at all different types of energy, what's out there, what type of waves, when, where can I find it? How can I see it? How do I see a radio wave? How do I see an electromagnetic wave? Mm-hmm. How do I do all this? And then making observations. So the one thing, and I think nearly any paranormal investigator will tell you, is that everybody has a problem with batteries. Everything gets drained. You know, you have to always bring backup. But yet all we do when we go there is we try to measure EMF,
yeah,
right? Where's that EMF? Well, EMF is an output energy. So if we're trying to get an entity to come, what input energy do they need? So I started thinking about that. And then with the batteries, I'm like, well, maybe it is potential chemical energy, because that's a battery. And so now I'm to the point, how do I provide that? How do I kind of set that free? And fortunately, my husband, he has a triple E. He's an electronic and electrical engineer. He works in the space industry, mm-hmm. but it really helps when it comes to electricity and different forms of energy to create basically like an open air battery that would release this type of energy.
Sure.
And like the next experiment we're going to do, we're trying to test it in small conditions now, you know, to release that and then hit it with some ions. I just don't want to cook anyone, so we have to test it before I use it. You know, I'm not trying to, you know, trigger a mutation here from the next X-Men.
Yeah.
So, but I'm looking at that. So what else? And I can say I don't think it's thermal energy, because we'd have ghosts running amok all day. Mm-hmm. And would it be an absorption? If they could absorb it all day and then it releases at night, and well, likely not, because there's an abundance of that. So if it's not that type of energy, what else is there? So that's the how. So if I can understand what type of energy is needed and then understand how to seed that energy, I don't know what will happen, which is a fantastic place to be. I'm very excited to see what would happen. I'm hoping something more than nothing happens. But just the thought is, if we could recreate it and then see it in the right visual spectrum, and not just visible, non-visible light to UV to IR range, but to see it in a radio wave, to see it in another form. Mm-hmm. Whether it's even using something similar as a Doppler radar to see the kind of atmospheric disturbances, which kind of seems like this would be along those lines. If we could do that and see it, could we see it on demand? Mm-hmm. Could there be, you know, a ghost light that eventually gets created? Oh, there you are, you know. And so that's way far-fetched. But the basis of it, so that is the how that I tackle. So on my team, I also work with one of my partners. He has his MBA, he's a licensed counselor, and he's great at qualitative research, as to where I do quantitative research. Mm-hmm. And so right now we're trying to take what I'm doing, but to couple it with what he also does to create a different type of test plan. I don't want to dismiss the emotional connection or spiritual connections or any of that aspect that may go along with this. We have yet to figure out how to couple that, but that's what we're working on. So this is how we get into the how of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, the ideas like that are what I sometimes discuss on the show with folks just like yourself, of, you know, where is this going? Like, where, you know, there's obviously been so many advancements over the years. And let's talk about some of those before we talk about, you know, what you see happening in the future. You know, things like the ghost box, things, there's a lot of interesting tools out there that seem to yield somewhat sensible results in many cases. I mean, what are your thoughts on things like that and how they're, you know, using those things to communicate, or even, you know, I mean, it would be like asking, you know, you or me to communicate through this box. I mean, I would be like, how am I supposed to communicate through that box you got over there? But it seems that there are results coming through. What are your thoughts on things like that that have evolved over the last 10, 15 years?
Well, I actually really like the spirit box. It's been one of the things that I've thought about here recently quite often. I would love to know and I don't know the person that actually came up with it, but I would love to know their thought process behind it, to why they think that would work. And hopefully it's not the Michael Keaton movie with the white noise, which is what I always think of.
Yeah,
I wonder. I mean, maybe, who knows? I don't know how that would work, other than it's basically getting on the same frequency, because again, we're talking about waves and energy. And so if you are not in a earthly container, if you're just an energy being, maybe it is easier to do that. Mm-hmm. And certainly I've had great results with spirit boxes and ghost boxes. But with a caveat on that. So, I have seen people use programs and different ones where they've picked up radio stations. Mm-hmm. And I was actually, I kid you not, in an investigation using somebody else's equipment, and they're really so excited because they're getting these blips of, you know, sound and words come through. And mm-hmm. It's like, wow, that's got a unique voice, right? Mm-hmm. And at the time I'm thinking, it's like a radio voice. What am I hearing? Mm-hmm. Then I heard Bruno Mars and I was like, okay,
yeah,
we piggybacked the station. So the ones that I've had really good results with are the ones that literally just generate noise and are not connected. So like not connected to the internet, not connected to any data streams. They just generate the noise. Mm-hmm. I've seen a couple good ones like you can use on your phone when you can go into like airplane mode and just get, just have the white noise. And I've used those in an investigation and have gotten almost, not full conversations, but decent sentences and things and responses in context. I was at Vulture Mind doing an investigation there last year in one of the buildings. And one of the questions I asked was, do you mind, like, are you okay with people being here? Because there's a lot of people that constantly run through.
Yeah.
And I know as a human, it would be exhausting to me to have to see that many people, but maybe as a spirit, you don't mind.
Yeah.
And the answer I got was, you better believe it. Clear as day. I was like, okay, excellent. I'm glad you have company. But using that, so I also ask different questions, and this is one of the things that I feel is great. So in that same session that I was doing it, using this one particular spirit box, I asked, you know, how do you see me? Do you see me as a person? Do you see me as energy? Mm-hmm. Like, how do I look to you? And I get a response, energy. Oh, it's like, okay. How do you see others? Trying to ask and understand the other side's perception of us. So we try to understand them and see them. Mm-hmm. How, if we turn that around, how do they see us?
Sure.
If they're seeing us as energy, well, that kind of leads into more than we need to find the right input energy. I mean, humans, we generate enough BTUs to, I'm not sure what we light up, but we can. Like if it's collected over time, we absolutely generate energy. So they see us. Can we recreate that?
Yeah.
So, but then I've also seen ones, I forget the name of it. It's pretty popular, but this one person was using it and, you know, they've got a child coming through and they've got an adult coming through on demand that they're talking for like 4 hours straight. And it's like, no, that's not even remotely believable. And that this particular program could be pre-programmed for responses and different things. I'm like, that to me, that irritates me because you're bringing in, you know, bad stuff. It's you're bringing in what people think are already fake and you're injecting that into what we're trying to do.
Sure.
So, yeah, there's a lot of different types of tools and equipment out there. But how some people use it and what they do with it, I think, brings us many steps back for every half step we take forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, anything can be, you know, essentially, okay, we can do this with it. And then suddenly it's going to look a lot more, you know, exciting on the YouTube videos or whatnot versus reality where it's like, this takes a little bit of work to get it, going. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I totally agree because, you know, doing this for a while, and anyone that does this will tell you, you know, happenings and events are rare. Mm-hmm. Most of the time I spend my time sitting in the dark and nothing, mm-hmm. you know, you're asking questions and nothing, and you record and nothing. That's more usual. You just don't get events where you've got a ghost that's super, super chatty for hours on end. Mm-hmm. You know, it's skeptical, so. Yes.
What's your opinion? And when you're asking questions, you're asking things that are, you know, it's not the same five questions that I would imagine these spirits get on a regular basis from every, you mm-hmm. know, investigator that walks through the, what's your name? How'd you die? That sort of stuff. Yeah. You're getting right to the, you know, the core and talking to them like a person. Like, okay, you're over mm-hmm. here, I'm over here. We get this. We've already established that part. And you're really asking stuff that they probably don't get asked very often. Do you find that you get more responses that way versus asking the old, you know, five go-to get to know you questions?
Sometimes. So you had mentioned, you know, speaking to them like a person. So when I do it, it's very conversational. Mm-hmm. I've observed, you know, when you're, what's your name? Why are you here? Well, can you tell me your name? And I know personally, I would be like, I just told you, why are you asking me again?
Yeah.
So when I say it, because I do, I still ask those, hi, what's your name? I will say, you know, I can't really hear you. I think I heard you. Could you say it again? Mm-hmm. And then I will continue on. And then when I do start getting responses, I will use that in a basic line of conversation. As we are speaking now, if I ask a question and I can't really hear it, but it sounds like something that got a positive response, mm-hmm. I will say, oh, great, you did get that. Okay, well, then let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. And keep it going that way. And when it does happen, like when it happened in Wickenburg, it was a huge line of conversation. And I'm getting those responses and I'm keeping it going. And I did feel like I got more. At the same time, I've done it and it's been crickets. So it's hit or miss. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what conditions and circumstances are different in one place to another that enables it in one place to another. And then, you know, is it a willingness on the spirit's part? Maybe they're like, I'm done with you. I'm not saying a word, go away. Or they really want to be engaged. So
sure.
A lot of unknown with that. But I do feel like if you do engage with it, as you know, with the entity, as you would anyone else, I believe, it creates a better result. I've also seen people go, give me a sign that you're here, and you hear a knock and they go running the other way. Mm-hmm. And you just, it's like, what? What are you doing?
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Amanda. In part two, what are Amanda's thoughts on the word generating devices out there to use to communicate with the deceased? Where does Amanda think the field will be 20 years from now? What are Amanda's thoughts on entities that were not human that people claim to experience? And can we create our own hauntings with our own energy? Until next time, for The Grave Talks, Tony Bruschi, thanks for listening.